This CityWire podcast is sponsored by Scottish Mortgage Investment Trust. Scottish Mortgage invests in some of the world's most promising and exceptional companies. From healthcare breakthroughs to electric vehicles to a green energy revolution, Scottish Mortgage takes stakes in businesses shaping our future economy and society. As with any investment, capital is at risk.
Hello, my name's John Schaefer and welcome to The Wealth Show from CityWire. Today, I'm here with Sebastian Lyon, manager of the Troy Trojan Fund. Sebastian, thank you so much for talking to me today.
Pleasure, John.
Excellent. So obviously pretty severe inflation pressure, not just in the UK, but globally. What strategies are you putting in place to generate a positive real return?
Well, I think that's a really big challenge for investors at the moment. Over the life of the fund, which is now 21 years old, we've generated real returns of about 3.6% per annum. But I think that just at the moment, obviously, when you're talking about real returns, you're talking about the return less inflation. Now, if inflation's at 10.1%, which was announced yesterday in the UK, and in a rising real interest rate environment, which we're in at the moment, the world's changed in the last year, and interest rates have been rising very sharply, that's been an incredibly difficult environment to protect capital in nominal terms, let alone in real terms. I mean, there'll be very, very few people out there who will have generated a positive real return over the last year. And frankly, I think we're flat or down 1% over the last year in nominal terms. So clearly we're behind in real terms. One has to think about the long term rather than about the immediate real return that clearly, I think one needs to be objective and needs to inform investors that that is going to be a challenge. That doesn't mean to say that we're not targeting real returns over the long term, and we have generated those. But I think in the short term, it's going to be very tough.
Sure. I mean, drilling down on that, it sort of your prospectus says you target real returns over the longer term, over 5 to 7 years. You're mentioning over the long term, focusing on that, but you still got quite a way to go. If you say you're down 1% in nominal terms, what can you do to achieve that inflation beating return over the 5 to 7 year period?
Well, I think the key thing is, and one of the things that we've done at Troy over the medium to long term, is that we've been aware that the current menu is not necessarily the menu that will be available to investors over the next year or two or three. And I think you need to be, and what I mean by that is that the environment can change. It can actually become more positive for investors. And what I mean by that in terms of future returns is actually lower prices. So I think that at the moment we're very defensively positioned. We batten down the hatches, for want of a better description, we're preserving nominal value. If we're going to be able to generate real returns and above average returns in the future, effectively valuations, we think, need to be lower. So in 2021, when we effectively saw, and certainly the first half of 2021, after the pandemic, we were seeing effectively a bubble in right across asset classes, whether it be fixed income, whether it be alternatives, whether it be equities, and particularly, obviously, we saw it very patently in meme stocks and unprofitable tech. Clearly, in that environment, which was similar, although not identical, to the one that we saw during the dot-com boom, you wanted to be reducing risk materially. If you were increasing risk during that environment, you were looking at very, very poor returns indeed. We're fortunate enough to have the luxury that we can step back. If we think that valuations are very high and the risk is to the downside rather than the upside, we can step back, protect capital, which is sort of essentially what we've done over the last year, and wait for things to improve in terms of valuations. And that's really what's beginning to happen and what began to happen at the beginning of this year. So with equity markets having fallen, valuations have fallen back. Clearly, we've seen that bubble effectively burst. But now what we're doing is we are awaiting better opportunities, which we think will be forthcoming in a downturn, which is effectively what we're likely to be seeing next year in terms of a recession, both in the UK and in the US and in Europe. And that ultimately will provide us with the types of valuation where we can generate good medium to long-term returns and real returns, particularly in equities, less so in fixed income.
Well, speaking about valuations and drilling down on fixed income, let's talk about UK treasuries. I mean, you've got more than 20% in UK treasuries in your portfolio at the moment. I assume that's
very short dated.
Very short dated, but I assume you've still been hit somewhat by that. I mean,
no, not really. No, I mean we've been in T-bills and in which are, you know, less than a year. And we've only very recently, literally in the last 3 months, been buying into short-dated gilts.
Yep.
And one of the things that has really changed, John, over the last, well, literally 3 months, let alone the last year, is that we've moved very, very quickly from an era of zero interest rates to an era of the old world, if you like,
sure.
Of higher interest rates. And you can, with the fallout of the gilt market that occurred after the mini budget, you could lock in over 4, if not 4.5% in 1 to 2 year money. Yeah. So you are now suddenly getting a very good return on your cash. I mean, when I say very good, I hasten to add that's not a real return.
Not in real terms, of course.
10%.
Yeah.
But you are at least getting something for a return. You're getting a risk return. A risk-free return, if you like, which you haven't had for a decade and a half.
What does that mean for your portfolio? Does that mean sort of short-dated gilts are you're particularly bullish on at the moment?
Yeah, well, I think the interest rates are ultimately going to rise in the very short term, but I think at some stage, probably in the next, quite quickly, let's say the first quarter of next year, I suspect that interest rates are going to peak, both in the US and the UK. Doesn't necessarily mean they're going to be slashed lower, but it means that they're not going to go up an awful lot more from about between 4 and 5%.
Hmm.
So, from a point of view of having not been able to lock in anything like that over the last 13 years or so, we think that actually that's quite attractive, and we think investors who have been dragooned into taking more and more and more risk over the last decade, because they weren't earning a return on cash, so they've been moved into higher risk securities and funds. Suddenly, now investors can lock in, you know, historically not a reasonable rate, and basically we're back to the world that we were before the financial crisis, when rates were between sort of 4 and 5%. It's a very big change.
Where do you sit more generally on fixed income duration? Is it all short dated for you, sort of outside of UK government debt?
So we have got US linkers,
yep.
TIPS, and there our duration has been very short. I mean, one of the things that we recognised coming into this year is that duration was the risk. That was where whether it be in equities or whether it be in fixed income, and the more duration that you had, the worse effectively your return. So you've seen that in long dated gilts, you've seen that in long dated index linked in the UK, which we don't hold and intentionally haven't held for the last 5 years because we felt they were very poor value. In the US, US TIPS were considerably better value than in the UK. Inflation actually, interestingly, hasn't been that different in the US than the UK. And bear in mind that although the index link market does move around with the conventional market, we are at least getting that inflation. And if we're in short-dated bonds, we're getting that inflation, you know, full-on in terms of without taking a very material amount of duration risk. So a lot of the exposure that we have with an Trojan fund in TIPS and in index linked have been pretty short-dated. So we're not taking a huge risk with duration, and we are picking up that inflation, you know, week in, week out, month in, month out, which you're not getting in conventional bonds.
And that seems to be your most bullish position. You've got about 38% in US TIPS. Do you think that's going to continue to be the case over the next sort of 6 months or so?
Yeah, I think we've probably got enough exposure there, but, you know, around 35%. I mean, it's slightly moved up, partly because the equity part has moved down. But around the 35% we feel is where we want to be. I mean, do bear in mind that essentially a lot of that is, again, quasi-liquidity. So because it's short duration, we're not taking a huge high risk. So on the basis that we've got around 25% liquidity, pure liquidity, short-dated gilts, cash, etc., and then with the tips, as you say, we've got 38%. So you could say that really we're about 50% liquid or quasi-liquid at the moment. But we'd rather get it through through index linked, particularly with what's happening with inflation at the moment. But suddenly now conventional short daters are offering these much higher yields. They have now become more attractive.
And what about sort of sterling weakness? What are you doing to hedge that? Is the sort of US Treasuries strategies part of that? You know, what other things are you doing in your portfolio to hedge the sterling's weakness?
Yeah, so my colleague Mark DeVos wrote a really good paper about this earlier in the year about the dollar. And one of the things that we highlighted was that we felt that the dollar, in a world where all asset prices were likely to fall, the dollar was a one place where one could get some protection from those falling asset classes, as effectively people reverted to the dollar. And that's pretty much exactly what's happened. And we have benefited this year. I mean, the fund's down about 4% year to date, I think maybe 4.5% year to date. That would be considerably worse had we not had a material dollar exposure of around 30% within the fund. So the dollar's been very helpful. Clearly, sterling's been very weak. Having said that, it is worth highlighting that all developed market currencies and many emerging market currencies have been weak. And actually, the focus has been, for very understandable reasons in the last month or so, on sterling weakness, for all of the reasons that we know in terms of the mini budget. But actually, if you look at the euro, if you look at the yen, if you look at other currencies, they've all been very weak. It's been much more about dollar strength than it has been about sterling weakness. But the dollar has protected us to some extent this year, and we've been aware of that. It's been a very helpful hedge for us. But we have back at the end of September, beginning of October, we did reduce our dollar exposure when sterling got very, very oversold. Down in the sort of mid 105, 106, 107, those sorts of levels, after the collapse, after the mini budget, we just felt we didn't want to take quite as much dollar risk. So having been 30% dollar risk for much of this exposure, for much of this year in the fund, we moved it back down to the low 20s. So we've taken it down roughly by a bit less than a third, because we just felt that the risk for sterling was more evenly balanced rather than not, particularly when we saw that breakdown. But we think the dollar still has a role to play if there continues to be a flight to quality. So we still want to have some exposure to the dollar.
Sure. You've got a pretty significant allocation to gold in the portfolio. It seems above 10%. And obviously, prices of gold have recently hit a 2.5-year low, you know, affected by dollar strength as well. Why are you bullish on the precious metal?
Yeah. Well, I think that there's, John, there's sort of two answers to that question. There's a sort of long-term question and a short-term question. So the long-term issue with gold is that we think and have believed for quite some time that we live in a world of financial repression. And what I mean by that is effectively negative real rates, i.e. the level of inflation is likely to be above the level of interest rates. And in that environment, generally speaking, gold does well. Gold does very, if you look back in history, gold does very badly in periods of positive real rates. There's been a lot of chat recently of sound money. And there's a lot of politicians saying they believe in sound money. I'm afraid they might believe in it, but they're not practicing it. And they haven't been practicing it for a very long time. Sound money means that you're earning at least a real positive real rate on your cash. And we haven't had that really since the financial crisis. And so we think that gold, as, if you like, a currency that can't be debased, a currency that can't be printed, has a role to play within the portfolio. And over the life of our holding, which goes back to about 15 or 16 years, gold has actually made a very positive contribution to the fund, about 11% per annum in sterling terms and 8% per annum in US dollar terms. But it is, to your point, it's been noisy and it's not always, doesn't necessarily do what you expect it to do.
Okay.
Now, this year, it's worth pointing out, and you're absolutely right, in dollar terms, it's made a 2.5-year low recently in dollars. We don't hedge our gold. And so actually we're getting the sterling return. And actually only in the beginning of, a month ago, you were 1 to 2% away from an all-time high in gold in sterling.
Okay, I see.
So it's not as bad as it looks. Don't just look at gold in dollars. Look at gold in euros. Look at gold in yen, which has made an all-time high very recently. You know, looking gold in other currencies, don't just look at it in dollars. The reason why gold has been weaker this year has been because of very material dollar strength. So just bear that in mind. But coming back to your question about the future, I suspect that once we've seen the whites of the eyes of interest rates peaking, which will happen at some stage, probably in the next year, then I expect gold, the dollar will begin to, begin to, at least the strength will begin to abate. And at that point, I expect gold will probably do pretty well. There's another point that's just worth making about gold, which is that effectively we view it as sort of portfolio insurance, cheap insurance, so rather than using derivatives. And at periods of intense stress, like we had during the pandemic and that we had during the invasion of Ukraine in February, March time, it did a really good job in terms of helping us to defend when other asset prices were suffering.
Should we move on to some of your equity positions? Which stocks are you particularly bullish on currently?
Well, I think overall, I'm pretty cautious about equity markets and have been for the last year. And the reason for that is that we have lived in a world for a very long time of the sort of drip, drip, drip of very low rates, which has driven valuations of equities materially higher over a very long period of time. If you look particularly at higher quality growth equities, and we do like higher quality businesses rather than very highly cyclical asset intensive businesses, we like companies that are generally speaking financially productive and consistently financially productive and growing, which narrows the companies and the stocks that we like to own. These have all moved up in terms of valuation over the last decade or so. And so that's the reason why our equity allocation is so low. But what we do want to do is we do want to have some exposure to equities that are defensive, particularly when we're going into prospectively an economic downturn. So you don't want to have hugely cyclical or highly levered businesses where the cost of capital is rising because the cost of debt is rising. And so things like, for example, we saw yesterday two of our companies announce their profits, Procter & Gamble and Nestle. We were relieved to see, but Nestle grew their top line by 8 to 9%, most of which was pricing. But it's nice to be able to see companies being able to drive prices up, not at the cost of volume, and that these companies have got really strong pricing power. And therefore can grow their top line and can ultimately grow the bottom line and continue to grow their dividends consistently.
Are there sort of particular sectors that you're particularly bullish on in this kind of environment? I mean,
I think generally staples within this kind of environment are not a bad place to be.
So you've got Unilever there, haven't you?
Yeah, we have as well. And I think interestingly, Unilever is one where, you know, the rating is lower. For all of the reasons that we know, you know, since the Kraft Heinz bid back in 2017-18, what they described as a near-death experience, the company struggled somewhat. They overpromised in terms of their margin, and frankly, some of the company's communications have been better. Could have been better. But we actually saw in the last year or so the rating come down and the valuation now compared to peers looks pretty good. And so Unilever, which certainly wasn't, it was in our top 10, but it certainly wasn't in our top two or three. We've actually become more confident about the outlook for Unilever, particularly at this current valuation where the yield's almost sort of 4%. And that's about as safe yield as one can get in the equity market. So Unilever would certainly be one that we've been happy to increase as a percentage of the overall portfolio in the last sort of say 6 months.
Yeah. These are, why do you think that will do in a sort of more under sort of more difficult conditions?
So Visa is an interesting company, but I think that one needs to talk about it in the context of two sides of the business. The first is that payments are moving more electronic every day. I mean, the one thing that COVID has accelerated is the material reduction in the use of cash and the increase in electronic payments, not just online, but also, frankly, you know, you go and buy a cup of coffee these days and you use a card instead of using cash. And in fact, many places don't even take cash anymore. So there is an ongoing fundamental growth in there. And the UK is, people look at the UK, but the UK is way ahead on this. One of the few things we are well ahead of. The US is probably 2 to 3 years behind the UK in things like contactless payments. And so Visa and Amex, which we also hold, have got huge tailwinds from this point of view in terms of the business. The other thing that's just worth pointing out quickly is that if we do have inflation, actually these payments are benefiting from inflation, i.e. inflation just being passed on. So if you're paying 10% more for your cup of coffee that you were a year ago, that's obviously being charged. Visa are picking up their, you know, few pennies in the pound for that.
However, people might not go out to buy that cup of coffee at all if there's a more severe recessionary environment.
Yeah, transactions don't just disappear. I think the number of transactions that you will be instigating is not going to suddenly collapse. And the good thing is that you don't need to have large ticket items. You know, it can be small ticket items. So I think it's a smaller holding than it was in our portfolio. We've taken a few profits this year, end of last year in Visa. But longer term, it's a business we really like, and we think it's very well run. And obviously, it has that sort of very broad global presence. But we think payments, there is a very material tailwind for the business of payments, and which is why, you know, we hold Visa and actually we hold Amex as well. Amex we hold in slightly smaller size, purely because there's a balance sheet side to Amex in terms of the fact that it does lend in a way that Visa doesn't. Visa is very much just purely reliant on those transactions.
Any equity positions that you've been cutting recently or adding in the same breath?
We've taken a little bit of money out of on an ongoing basis this year. So in the summer, when we had the bear market rally, and I was convinced it was a bear market rally, we used the opportunity to just trim holding in Microsoft and Alphabet. And just because I feel that those stocks in the short to medium, we like them longer term, but in the short to medium term, i.e. over the next 18 months or so, we think that they will be vulnerable to earnings. And we haven't really seen the earnings downgrades yet in the overall market. That is something which is still to come, we expect, over the next year or so. So we just, purely on a risk reduction point of view, we just reduced those holdings somewhat. And then coming back to your point, John, about gold and gold weakness, we have seen the holding that we have in Franco-Nevada, which is a long-standing holding for us. It's done very well for us, but it's been somewhat weaker this year in the last sort of 6 months, and we're happy to just add to that a little bit as well.
Excellent. Just going back to Microsoft and Alphabet and earnings, I mean, a company like Microsoft, a lot of its earnings comes from sort of a subscription model. Do you think that's really, do you think earnings are really going to be affected on that basis?
Well, not all of it. I mean, I think they've been incredibly, the numbers at Microsoft have been incredibly robust. Partly due to their very strong pricing that they've had, and as you say, the recurring revenue. But I think what would concern me is market expectations are actually quite high, and the valuation differential with the rest of the market is also quite high. So expectations are high, and you've seen recently they've been reducing their headcount along with a number of other tech giants, which gives you an indication that they see things becoming more difficult in a sort of post-pandemic world. There is no doubt that the resilience of the business is very strong. But I think it's more a question of expectations of growth. No business is totally invulnerable to an economic downturn. And I suspect that's what they're preparing for in terms of reducing their headcount or at least stopping doing a hiring freeze.
Excellent. Well, Sebastian, thank you so much for joining me today.
Pleasure, John. Anytime.
This Citywire podcast is sponsored by Scottish Mortgage Investment Trust. Scottish Mortgage invests in some of the world's most promising and exceptional companies. From healthcare breakthroughs to electric vehicles to a green energy revolution, Scottish Mortgage takes stakes in businesses shaping our future economy and society. As with any investment, capital is at risk.